Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the May 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Support for Takes on the World comes from our members at FT, Family Tree Service, a licensed contractor serving the four-county area since 1989. FT, Family Tree Service, specializes in view enhancement, tree trimming, chipping, hazard tree removal, and storm damage at 984-6629. And from the Anderson Valley Advertiser, a community-based small-town weekly whose perspective on everything is likely to be at odds with received opinion. The Anderson Valley Advertiser is available every Wednesday at newsstands, online, and by subscription. Information and subscriptions available by emailing ava@pacific.net or by calling 895-3016. Whatever domestic political benefits that President Obama might have accrued for ordering the killing of Osama bin Laden a week ago Monday, they may prove to pale beside the problems Washington's latest affront to Pakistani sovereignty has called for the already strained U.S.-Pakistan relationship. With each new day, there comes new, only slightly muted accusations and demands from both sides. While the U.S. is calling for access to bin Laden's three surviving wives, now in Pakistani custody, Pakistani officials are warning against Washington attempting a repeat performance. In the meantime, Pakistan's Director for Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, is having to defend itself from charges that it was either complicit with bin Laden, having found sanctuary in the shadow of Pakistan's leading military academy, or acknowledging that it is guilty of a major intelligence failure. Then Monday, for the second time in 5 months, the Pakistan authorities have angered the CIA by tipping the Pakistani news media to the identity of the agency's station chief in Islamabad, which is being viewed in Washington as a deliberate effort to complicate the work of the American spy agency. The relationship between the ISI and the CIA has been particularly cool since Raymond Davis, a CIA operative for whom President Obama demanded diplomatic immunity, shot and killed two Pakistanis who he claimed were trying to rob him. Pakistani sources allege that the two men were actually ISI agents who were following Davis. Another Pakistani was then run down by a CIA colleague of Davis who hurried over to help him escape an angry Pakistani crowd that had gathered at the site of the killing. That agent was able to board a plane back to the U.S. before Pakistani authorities could arrest him, but the affair further angered a Pakistani population, which is overwhelmingly anti-American, not in the least because of the dramatic increase of fatal drone attacks since the Obama administration took over the war. Washington and the U.S. media seem to believe that the Pakistanis should ask how high when the U.S. tells it to jump, because of the billions of dollars in military aid that has been flowing to Pakistan, which the U.S. both sees and needs as its major ally in the war on both al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The national interests of Pakistan and the U.S. are far from identical, however, which has required the Pakistanis to play what observers are calling a double game. To sort out the potential implications of the dispute over the bin Laden assassination for the ongoing so-called war on terror, I will be speaking at about 20 minutes past the hour with London-based Middle East analyst and documentary filmmaker Phil Rees. There are many people here and abroad, including, I suspect, some of you, who are convinced that bin Laden has been dead since at least 2001, but none of the so-called experts who have put forth that opinion have provided any facts to back it up. Certainly, if he was dead and this raid by the U.S. Navy SEALs was staged to pump up Obama's reputation and that of the United States, it would be an impeachable offense. In truth, it should have been, if this was a nation that paid serious attention to international law. Commenting on the assassination, Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, pointed out, quote, "When he announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed by a Navy SEAL team in Pakistan, President Barack Obama said, justice has been done. Mr. Obama misused the word justice when he made that statement," she said. "He should have said, retaliation has been accomplished." A former professor of constitutional law should know the difference between these two concepts. The word justice implies an act of applying or upholding the law. Targeted assassinations, she noted, violate well-established principles of international law These are unlawful and deliberate killings carried out by order of or the acquiescence of a government outside any judicial framework. That's the United States in 2011 under President Barack Obama. Until I get my guest Phil Rees on the phone, let's take a look at some other stories that are or should be making the news that may be directly or indirectly affected by the bin Laden killing and what's happening in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. We'll start with the Arab Spring, in which, in their beginning, relatively peaceful popular uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt led to the downfall of two long-serving dictators. Now they have turned bloody as the remaining autocrats in the region, taking their cue from Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, have decided that armed suppression of these calling for regime change is the way to go. The difference is that Gaddafi is the only one who thus far is not being allowed to get away with it. Libya is now embroiled in what must be the most unusual civil war, with a disparate group of rebels backed by the U.S. and NATO air power, currently stalemated in their effort to overthrow that country's 42-year-old dictatorship. The autocrats of Bahrain, Yemen, and Syria have fared better so far. The protests in Bahrain, home to the U.S. Fifth Fleet, which began and remained peaceful, were brutally suppressed with barely a word of criticism from Washington or Europe. Meanwhile, dozens of doctors and nurses are among hundreds who remain in Bahraini prisons, charged with treating protesters who have been wounded at the hands of government forces and the occupying army sent in by Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates. In Yemen, an important front in the U.S. war on Al-Qaeda, weeks of mass nonviolent protest demanding the end to the 32-year reign of President Ali Saleh appeared to have achieved their aim when Saleh agreed to step down, but then refused to sign a statement of resignation without being assured immunity from criminal prosecution. At one point, Obama suggests that Saleh resign, but he has done nothing to follow it up, leading to the widespread conclusion that he is hoping that Saleh, like the King of Bahrain, can ride out the protests. In Syria, which has long been viewed as a problem for both Israel and the U.S. because of its ties to Iran and support for both Hezbollah and Hamas, Washington has been relatively restrained, as have been the Israelis, while the police and army of another president for life, Bashar al-Assad, has responded to growing protests by shooting those during the protesting and closing the borders to foreign journalists. As in all other situations in the region, Assad has blamed outsiders for stirring up what was previously considered one of the most stable countries in the Middle East. As to why both the U.S. and Israel are hesitant to call for the ouster of Assad, the answer is simple. They don't know who or what will emerge in his place, and fear will be the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. After all, thanks to a secret agreement between the two countries, the Syrian and Israeli borders have been quiet since the 1973 war. A very different and unusual situation can be found in Iran, which went through a period of bloody repression following the disputed presidential election of 2009. Last week, Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was faced with an ultimatum from the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who reportedly told him to accept the reinstatement of the country's intelligence minister, who Ahmadinejad had fired, or he should quit. The Guardian of London reported that a member of the Iranian parliament, Morteza Agha Tehrani, who is described as Ahmadinejad's moral advisor, told a gathering of supporters on Friday that a meeting between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei had recently taken place, in which the president was given a deadline to either accept the decision of the Ayatollah or resign. In the apparent protest at Khamenei's ultimatum, Ahmadinejad staged an 11-day boycott of his own cabinet meetings. In the first meeting after his walkout ended, the intelligence minister, Haider Moslehi, was absent, and in the second one last Wednesday, he was reportedly asked by Ahmadinejad to leave. Although Khamenei is not constitutionally allowed to intervene in cabinet appointments, an unwritten Iranian law requires all officials to always defer to the opinion of the supreme leader. Clerics close to Khamenei have since launched a campaign to highlight his role in Iranian politics, saying that to disobey him is equal to apostasy, as he is, quote, God's representative on earth, end quote. Iran does have some good news, which will not please President Obama, nor Israel, and its trained SEALs in Congress, nor the Treasury Department, which has been working overtime on the U.S. taxpayers' dime to prevent Iran from selling its oil on the foreign market. now Washington's good ally, India, just after deciding to look elsewhere to spend $10 billion on new fighter aircraft, has announced that it has found a way to keep Iranian oil flowing its way. After having explored various options to make payments and having run out of them since most foreign banks have been frightened off by U.S. sanctions, India will pay for Iranian crude oil in rupees, its national currency. Under the newly floated but yet to be approved proposal, National Iranian Oil Company will open rupee accounts with Indian banks and will be able to use the money to purchase non-strategic items. The big news in Washington, besides the president having shown his birth certificate, is that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is coming to town. And so am I, but that's not a very big story. The Israeli Prime Minister has accepted an invitation by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker John Boehner to address a joint session of Congress on May 24th while he's in Washington for the annual conference of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, whose power in Washington is unmatched by any other political lobby, domestic or foreign. If past is prologue, and when it comes to AIPAC, it usually is, this conference will be bigger than the last, and at least half of the members of Congress will be in attendance and have their names read aloud. This is for the benefit of those who are inclined to contribute to the campaigns of those representatives of ours who are ready to put Israel's interests at least as high as those of their fellow Americans, if not higher. Netanyahu will deliver his speech to the lawmakers, 4 days after he meets at the White House with President Obama, whose relationship with the Israeli leader, the Jerusalem Post notes, has, quote, sometimes been strained, unquote. That's putting it mildly. Routine humiliation at Netanyahu's hands is a better description. One of the gains that Obama may have been made or trying to make from having his Navy SEALs take out bin Laden is that his poll numbers are up and he has, at least temporarily, set aside his wimp image. Of course, Netanyahu's mission will be to make sure that Washington does not have anything to do with the Palestinian Authority now that it has agreed to a unity government with Hamas, which everyone in Israel and Washington consider to be a terrorist organization. To ensure this, 29 Democratic members of the Senate have signed a letter to Obama stating, quote, the United States should stand by its refusal to work with any Palestinian government that includes Hamas. It is imperative for you to make clear to President Abbas that Palestinian Authority participation in a unity government with an unreformed Hamas will jeopardize its relationship with the United States, including its receipt of U.S. aid. We urge you to conduct a review of the current situation and suspend aid should Hamas refuse to comply with quartet conditions, end quote. Those conditions include recognition of Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, a renunciation of violence against the Jewish state, and a willingness to adhere to all prior agreements. Israel, of course, has not been asked to renounce violence or recognize the right of the Palestinians to have a state of their own, or follow through on all prior agreements. But that should come as no surprise. Secretary of State Clinton had said on April 12th that the Obama administration planned a new push to promote comprehensive Arab-Israeli peace in coming weeks. That was before the Palestine Authority and Hamas called for unifying. Anyway, that Clinton's statement correctly noted the Jerusalem Post, quote, could risk alienating Israel's strong base of support in Congress, as well as the influential pro-Israel lobby in Washington, as Obama seeks re-election 2012, end quote. Obama's launch of direct Israeli-Palestinian peace talks last year went nowhere, and he is under pressure to forge a new initiative from the EU, or face the prospect of the Palestinians seeking the UN General Assembly's blessing for a Palestinian state in September. That and the Palestinian Union Agreement will be the subject of my next program, which will be a week from now on May 17th. On May 25th, the date of my next regularly scheduled program, you will hear Joy LeClaire in Forthright Radio, since I will be on my way back from Washington after participating in the Move Over AIPAC counterconference sponsored by Code Pink, which begins in the nation's capital on May 20th. I'll tell you all about that on my return.